Hello, everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Laura Romans, and I'm here with Lab 111's head of cinema, Tom Ohms.
Hello there.
When most people think of David Bowie, they think of music first. David Bowie has always played different roles in his musical career, so it was a logical step that in 1976, after already having released 10 studio albums, David Bowie decided to veer into acting. Bowie wasn't interested in becoming a big Hollywood star. He deliberately chose small and interesting projects that often mirrored the same themes and uniqueness that we heard in his music. Whether it was as an alien in The Man Who Fell to Earth, a goblin king in Labyrinth, a vampire in The Hunger, or just as himself in Christiana F., David Bowie always brought his own uniqueness to the screen. So in this episode, we're going to discuss why we love David Bowie. For the 10th anniversary of his passing and the 50th anniversary of The Man Who Fell to Earth, we're screening a ton of David Bowie movies at Lab 111 in the coming weeks. But check out the rest of our program at Lab 111 to see what else is going on at your favorite rep cinema in Amsterdam. For example, Schmutz Cinema on the 19th of March, a program where erotic imagination meets cinematic invention. Playful, queer, and joyfully open-minded. But first, Tom, what have you been watching?
I decided to, every week, watch a 1 hour and 30 minute movie from at least the 1940s.
What an odd number.
Yeah, because it's nice to, if you're really tired and
just
1.5 hours.
Sweet, I love how you said that.
What?
I love the 1 hour and 30 minutes.
1 hour and 30 minutes.
Yes.
So I watched Ernst Lubitsch's To Be or Not to Be.
Tell me about it.
It's a screwball comedy by Ernst Lubitsch about a acting troupe that gets embroiled in a Polish soldier's efforts to track down a German spy during the German occupation of Poland.
What makes it special?
What makes it special? I think it's one of the best written films I've seen in a long time. I mean, I love movies from the 1940s, but this was so intricately written, so many things happening at the same time. I always love foreshadowing, especially when you get like foreshadowing in 40s movies is something that for some reason that feels really modern. Like, okay, so you see something and then it happens later on in the film, it makes more sense. And here's a beautiful foreshadowing of a sort of side character within that acting troupe who's not really good at acting, who quotes the Merchant of Venice famous scene all the way in the beginning, and then all the way in the end of the film he needs to portray a Jew to get out of a situation where there are a lot of Nazis around, and then he performs that monologue again.
Oh, delightful.
But then it makes complete sense because he is himself a Jew. It's beautifully done. It's really amazingly written. And it was, I think it's one of my Letterboxd 5-star films. I haven't seen many bona fide five star movies where I'm like, okay, I've seen this, boom, it's 5-star. No debate, no thinking about it.
What was it called again? Because I'm adding that to the watch list.
To Be or Not to Be.
To Be or Not to Be. I'm adding it to the watch list.
And there's no Paul Mescal with a nice little earring. It's nothing like that.
I only see upsides.
So, Laura, what have you been watching?
So, a couple of episodes ago, I bragged how many movies I'd already seen because there were only like 5 weeks into the year and I'd watched like 65 movies or something. I've been stuck at that number because I downloaded a game called Hello Kitty Island Adventure.
What?
So, I've been doing is like every waking moment, I'm on this island with Hello Kitty and she's asking me to do little tasks. So,
what?
So I haven't really been watching a lot of movies because all of my time is being eaten up by Hello Kitty and her friends on this like PlayStation game that I have.
You're worse than my stepmom. My stepmom watches films on Netflix in like a minimized screen on her iPad while playing Candy Crush. At least she is also watching films while playing a mind-numbing game.
I've just been doing little tasks for Hello Kitty.
Well, what are the little tasks that Hello Kitty does you do? Why are you a servant of an IP? There you go.
Beats me. Honestly,
capitalism's really got to you.
So I haven't really been watching a lot of movies. I think, embarrassingly, I have to admit that the only movies I watched this week were Sister Act 1 and Sister Act 2, Back in the Habit.
I was so happy that your Letterboxd review was exactly the only thing that you can say about this film. It is
a great
best,
title.
It's the best sequel title ever. Sister Act 2, Back in the Habit.
It's genius. That movie is ass, but
better than Electric Boogaloo. What is it? Breaking to Electric Boogaloo.
To Electric Boogaloo, yeah. David Bowie. So we have big old program running at Lab 111 with some of the movies that he appeared in. Can you talk a little bit about why we're doing that, Tom?
This is just a very personal thing. I love David Bowie. There are two Davids that I cried when they died. One is Lynch, the other is Bowie. And I think when I was in my 20s, Bowie was just very important to me. Mm-hmm. And that's weird because it's late Bowie, so it's not like music-wise. Yeah. I was getting into David Bowie when he was making tracks like Thursday's Child. Remember that video clip where he had the longer hair and he was in front of a mirror singing to himself and then he turned into his younger self?
I don't remember that.
It's not a great time. It's not, like musically, it's not the best, but it got me into his works, and then you easily get to Heroes and Lansane and all the. And I always thought he was just a very fascinating character, in a way, and I think that, as I wrote in the text that we of the program text, I think that he's one of the artists where it's interesting in how he as an artist functions. Constantly performing a different character. It starts with Ziggy Stardust, then it goes into the Finn Wright Duke, I think, and then Aladdin Sane, and all these are like different characters within his body of work. He sort of changes into, he's a bit of a chameleon.
Changes!
There you go. And it's as though the silver screen is just another sort of canvas for him to work on and practically do the same thing. He just becomes a different character constantly. And
but they all fit beautifully into the Bowie-verse, yeah. In a way.
Yeah, and he's a good actor. He pulls it off pretty damn well.
I'm not trying to say here I don't know who David Bowie is.
Oh.
But you speak both of how like he's so special, but maybe try to put to words why he means so much for people, because I don't have the same relationship to David Bowie and his music. So I think it might be helpful for some of our listeners.
He was incredibly transformative in his music. Basically, if you listen to his first 10 albums, it kind of starts in this kind of acoustic, and he just really grew into this enigmatic character that really experimented a lot with his music, and he always created these characters. So it's kind of like Taylor Swift avant la lettre, in the sense that he had these eras, if that makes sense for you. Yeah. As a Gen Z. He basically created these albums, and then he was like a character, Ziggy Stardust, for example. And that album was kind of like a concept album, and it came with a look. And then like Thin White Duke, he had a little suit, and the music kind of fit the aesthetic. So he was always a master of creating a fully 360 vision of what he was creating at the time.
Well, no, to find somebody or something that is at the same from now, or from more recognizable artists from now, that is a bit the same. Because if you
let's be clear, I'm not comparing Taylor Swift to David Bowie in any way.
No, but I'm thinking like, what's the same sort of level of, on one side, invention, but also, I mean, he's a pop artist.
Yeah.
But if you listen to albums like Low or Heroes, where especially Low is interesting, because if you listen to that album, one side of the album is completely instrumental, almost sounds like an ambient album, really. He's then producing with Brian Eno, who's this big German ambient artist. So it's incredibly experimental, but he's also a pop artist, and he is also really a performer. And so I wondered, like,
he was also incredibly intelligent. Like, if hear him in interviews, he's incredibly well-spoken and like a trailblazer when it comes to like rights for other people. He was always very outspoken about like human
you were
rights.
Mentioning that MTV interview.
It occurred to me, having watched MTV over the last few months, it's a solid enterprise and it's got a lot going for it. I'm just floored by the fact that there's so few black artists featured on it. Why is that?
It's amazing. He just asked the MTV interviewers, like, why aren't you playing more music?
Well, it's
by
not
black
an
artists?
Interview about that at all.
No.
The thing that I feel people maybe reference a lot is also how it made them feel, of how like David Bowie is some kind of outsider in a way, or his music allowed people to embrace themselves or celebrate themselves in some ways. Mm-hmm.
We've mentioned Velvet Goldmine on the podcast before, which is not officially about David Bowie, but it's kind of about the era of like when that was happening, like he was wearing makeup as a man and he was wearing platform heels and glitter jumpsuits.
He is the example of the androgynous man.
So that was absolutely like back in the 70s, that was huge. And you can imagine like if there was outrage about Elvis shaking his pelvis or the Beatles making the devil's music, this was an absolutely different wheelhouse of how different this artist was at the time with his, like, I am from space. And, you know, he's always portrayed as, he always portrayed himself as this person who was like, was he human?
Was he queer?
Yeah. Or was he like, there was always a lot of mystery surrounding him. So if you feel like an outsider, if he felt like an outsider in those times, it was very, I'm assuming I wasn't around, but I'm assuming it was what? I had really good work.
I'm 24. I'm
assuming that it would have meant a lot to people that he was really breaking the mold in such insane ways.
Yeah, and kept doing that every decade, yes, with a different sort of iteration of brackets himself. Was it himself? There's always the question: where does David Bowie start, and where does the thin white Duke or one of these characters or versions of him begin?
So that fit in really well with then in 1976 going into an acting career. And yeah, the first important role that he had was The Man Who Fell to Earth, which we're now screening again because it's its goddamn 50th anniversary.
Nothing you have seen or heard about David Bowie will prepare you for the impact of his first dramatic performance in The Man Who Fell to Earth. This is another dimension of David Bowie, one of the few true originals of our time.
You're really a freak.
He plays an alien who comes to Earth to save his dying planet. And it's a very slow cinema, kind of like, he's just basically just like, be walking around.
Yeah.
Trying to like,
So it's a fascinating film. I think Bowie is very well cast as an alien. I mean, it plays to the strengths of the thinking that this man is otherworldly.
Absolutely.
But there's something funny, I think. I think the films of Nicholas Roeg, who directed this, are all pretty damn dated. Or maybe not dated, they're incredibly 70s. So the editing is mind-boggling. It moves from one scene to the next. Things are happening at the same time. You get
also,
like,
a lot of this is about like scientific papers and like briefcases and stuff, which I wasn't expecting.
It's a really strange film, yeah. But it is interesting. And what it does really well is that it shows you for the first time that even if Bowie does nothing on screen, he's incredibly enigmatic to look at. And I think that that is something that, funnily enough, Nicholas Roeg also made a film called Performance with another pop artist icon,
Mick Jagger.
Oh, Mick Jagger.
Mick Jagger doesn't work as well on screen. I mean,
I'll tell you that much for free.
But I think The Man Who Fell to Earth is a fascinating film. I'm happy that it's being re-released and that it can be watched again. Is it Bowie's most interesting performance in a film? No.
No, it's Labyrinth.
It's we'll get to Labyrinth.
I'm just chomping at the bit. Let me talk about Labyrinth. We want to hear from you. We're currently running a quick survey about the podcast so we can constantly keep improving what works, what doesn't work, what should we talk about. We have 100 euros worth of prizes, including merch, vouchers, and posters for 5 lucky entries to say thanks for giving your opinion. You can find a link to the survey in the show notes.
Somewhere between the lines of showing Bowie as using him as an actor and sort of using him as the icon that he is in real life is his next movie, Christiane F.
Wir Kinder von Bahnhof Zoo.
So I have a really strange relationship with this film in that I needed to watch this
in school.
In school.
Same. So just
really?
Yes.
So, oh my God, I thought I was the only one being traumatized.
No, I think this was like a nationwide, maybe Europe wide is like.
What for? So,
have you seen it, Elliot?
Yeah, I've seen it.
So yeah, it's basically this.
What for? What do you think, what for? Not use heroin.
Really, this show?
Yeah, like I feel like our entire generation was so scared of like hard drugs.
Well, our parents were afraid of. There was a literal heroin epidemic in our country that during the 90s. So sure, but this is one of the most. What are you laughing
earlier,
about?
Earlier, right? Wasn't it?
This is so traumatizing to be show Christiana.
Yes, yeah, but it worked. I never did heroin, so la-di-da, it fucking worked.
I did, but still. No, honestly, it's an incredibly depressing film.
Yeah.
Based on a book by the real-life Christiane F. about a girl who's stuck in Berlin and in this group of kids who...
She's like 13,
she's
right?
She's 13, and they're constantly shooting up heroin, and Bowie appears in his station album look, like this big red jacket, performing, like, I think... Yeah, somewhere in Berlin. And she passes him and sees him as like almost like a mirage, like something that she's... It's a cameo, really, but he does play a very important part for... Yeah. He plays himself.
He doesn't even like play in the movie, really. It's just like a concert, and it's a very pivotal moment for her where you can almost feel that she finds meaning in life through David Bowie, which, relatable. but yeah, so it's not even that he like... stars in that movie as like an actor. It's just like someone, she goes to that concert and you can just see her go, whoa, okay, what have I been doing? Holy shit. So it's a super pivotal scene. It's really cool that they got David Bowie to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's also insane how his star power translates so easily onto screen. Like if you do it with any other big artist, I don't think that works in the same way. No, but I'm just thinking, you guys watch Christiana F, and then what, kids today watch Euphoria. Those are two very...
Oh, I don't know. If you're Gen Alpha or young Gen Z, can you let us know if they show you Euphoria in school?
Do we need to talk about Tony Scott's The Hunger? Did we discuss that one on our vampire episode?
So we did. I think we briefly touched on it in the vampire episode. We did screen it back then in the vampire program as well here at Lab.
It's a weird, damn weird film. For some reason, really makes sense that it's him. Again, there's this sort of interplay between him as this otherworldly being that doesn't feel like he could age, but then the movie really is about a person aging rapidly, or a vampire aging rapidly. It's a weird film. I always thought it was... there's this weirdly sexual nature to it that, of course, always vampire movies, usually vampire movies have. I wouldn't say it's the most interesting one. I do think that the movie that that comes out in the same year, the Nagisa Oshima film Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, which for some reason I have the feeling a lot of people know more by the soundtrack from the Japanese composer Ryuichi Sakamoto than they would know the film itself, because it's not screened that often. It took me quite a while to actually find the rights and to be able to screen it. But it is a very beautiful film about as a POW camp where one of the British inmates tries to sort of solve a, not really a resurrection, but a like an upstirring between the Japanese side of it and the British side. It's a beautiful film. It's a very beautiful sort of culture clash movie. Laura, I think we quickly just need to move on to the most important subject of this podcast for you.
Labyrinth.
It's Labyrinth.
TriStar Pictures announces the collaboration of three extraordinary talents. Jim Henson, creator of The Muppets and Dark Crystal.
Where you go with a head like that?
George Lucas, creator of the Star Wars saga. And one of the most innovative forces in modern entertainment, David Bowie. Together, they will take you into a dazzling world of fantasy and adventure.
There's nothing to be afraid of.
A world where anything seems possible, and nothing is what it seems.
I mean, Labyrinth is one of my favorite movies of all time. You will often have seen me wear my Labyrinth sweater. You will have seen Labyrinth posters in my house. I love Labyrinth. Happy when we're screening it here at Lab. So in Labyrinth, David Bowie plays the role of Jareth, the Goblin King, and we have Sarah, who's like a teenage girl, who's babysitting her little brother Toby. She wishes for Toby to be captured by the Goblin King, to be taken away, because she doesn't want to babysit her brother. She wants to do cool teenager stuff. So what happens? David Bowie, as Jareth, the Goblin King, takes away the baby puts him in the center of a labyrinth, and Sarah has to go find her little brother. Meanwhile, there's a weird sexual tension between this, like, 43-year-old David Bowie and 15- or 16-year-old Sarah.
Played by Jennifer Connelly.
Played by the beautiful Jennifer Connelly. However, people say it's weird, and it is weird, but I do think it is a really great portrayal of what it is to be at that weird cusp of being a teenager and starting to have, like, romantic or sexual feelings about maybe, like, older people or, like, Fuck that, I said that weird. That is true. That is a weird thing to say. However, I think anyone who has been a teenage girl can admit that that's true. You start looking at these, like, celebrities and things, and you start having sexual feelings about them, but maybe you're not quite ready to let go of your childhood and all the things that came with your childhood. And that is what Labyrinth really is about. She's kind of forced to let go of her childhood, but is she ready? But she's starting to have these feelings, but she's also not ready to have those feelings. And it's kind of brave that they made a movie about that weird, like, cusp of being a teenager.
Did you mention who directed this?
So it was directed by Jim Henson. He's the creator of The Muppets. He is the director of The Dark Crystal. He is responsible for everything that's love and light in this world. I'm a big Jim Henson fan, and Tom is looking at me with one eyebrow raised
because
he's trying to get a rise out of me.
I think if we use this as a clip, there needs to be a shot where I am not sitting here anymore, you know?
Oh, man. Well, so I love this movie, again, same as with Neverending Story, because there are a lot of fuck-ass puppets, and they're really cool, and the sets are amazing, and yeah, I also love the fact that David Bowie's in it. But a fun fact about Labyrinth is that David Bowie almost wasn't in it. First, they were like, okay, we're going to make this movie. It's going to be musical, so we need to get a big artist. How about Sting?
God damn it.
There he is. So, rumor has it, and none of these are actually super confirmed, but these are stories that have been going around a long time. So they asked Sting, they asked Mick Jagger, and they asked Michael Jackson.
Oh my God, Michael Jackson is the Goblin King.
And I believe it was Brian Henson, Jim Henson's... son who was like, no, you know who the kids are really into these days? It's that weird guy, David Bowie. And it was just the perfect match because I can't imagine Labyrinth, first of all, existing within the Michael Jackson verse, but the songs that David Bowie created for this movie are so great.
Yeah.
And so iconic. And his look as the Goblin King, I'd be remiss not to mention the bulge. Yeah. It's a very
I would be remiss. Sure, continue.
I mean, it's a thing that a lot of people have very strong feelings about.
I am so happy that this movie has been so important for you, for your, like,
sexual awakening. I am Sarah. We are all Sarah. So for those who can't immediately visualize what I'm talking about, look it up. David
show
Bowie
it
is
here.
Wearing...
We'll show it right here. It's going to be right
it's an
here.
Audio medium. David Bowie wears very tight gray leggings, and it really draws your eye to whatever pair of socks they stuffed in there. He has an incredibly obscene bulge throughout that whole children's movie. It's pretty wild. That's all I'm gonna say about it. But yeah, it's pretty iconic. I think. Do you like Labyrinth? You're making fun of me, but
no, I am. No, the funny thing is, I think I saw it around the same time as I saw the Neverending Story, and for some reason, in my mind, I remember everything from the Swamp of Sadness, but I can't remember a lot from Labyrinth. I think I need to rewatch
it. Yeah, we'll see it together.
Yeah, please.
Fun. This is
great.
Living for it. I don't want to watch you watch Labyrinth and try to look away from the bulge.
Great. Well, moving on from watching Labyrinth, which is going to feel like a crucifixion, The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're not screening that. Somebody asked us why.
We did at some point.
Yeah, yeah. No, we screened it before. I mean, I think it's a great film.
Is this the Scorsese film?
Yeah.
With Willem Dafoe as Hot Jesus. Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned.
Have you? He plays Pontius Pilate for like 5 seconds in this film. And I will say that So you've been with Hot Jesus, but also like Willem Dafoe for the entire movie is just contemplating, like, am I really Christ? And is he really Christ? That's what the movie tries to ask. And then out of nowhere comes like surprise Deus Ex Bowie. And
yeah, it's almost like I will a Marvel say reveal,
that
yeah.
then he, so that's not, I think, the best way to use somebody as recognizable as David Bowie, because it's something like, you're the guy that's crucifying Christ? Like, hello, hello.
Hello.
Get on the cross. Yeah.
Yeah, it is a little too, like, oh my God, there he is. And you're not supposed to be happy to see this right. guy.
No, it's not fantastic casting. What is fantastic casting, though, is his role as Andy Warhol in Basquiat.
Yes.
Now, I do not specifically really like that movie. It's a movie by Julian Schnabel about Jean-Michel Basquiat, the painter, artist in New York in the 80s, who tragically died way too young. Bowie plays Andy Warhol. Now, that is great casting. There's one of my favorite moments of any art-related movie ever in this film, where Jeffrey Wright, who plays Basquiat, some people may know. Yeah, Jeffrey wow. Wright.
Yeah,
exactly.
He's incredible.
And it's very young Jeffrey Wright playing
with
Basquiat.
Hair.
Lot of hair. Yeah, apparently he once had hair.
Wow.
He goes to the home of Andy Warhol, and he's busy with making an art piece. And he's just standing there, and it's a dude pissing on a big-ass piece of paper.
Dad, home?
Oh, hi, Jean. That's great, Frank. Can you, I don't know, whiz over here?
Oh, piss painting.
No piss painting, Jean. Oxidation art.
Yeah, I hate cleaning brushes, too.
I'm gonna do some more of these. Frank's been drinking this great Mexican beer, and it makes it go this great green.
Why don't you paint on him yourself?
I don't like beer.
It's a complete pastiche of Andy Warhol, but it really works. He has a lot of fun with that role.
So lastly, I kind of want to move on to what could have been, because David Bowie worked with David Lynch before on Fire Walk With Me, and he was set to appear in the Twin Peaks revival in 2017, but he sadly passed away in 2016 from liver cancer. Another thing that could have been, which I really wonder about, is that apparently David Bowie auditioned to be in Lord of the Rings.
What?
What?
For what?
We don't know, but there's an interview with Dominic Monaghan, who plays Mary in Lord of the Rings, where he says, yeah, I saw David Bowie in the audition room. He like signed in and went in for an audition. He's like, I assume it was for Gandalf, but I'm like, bitch, Elrond. Right?
I mean, yeah.
Like, that's Lord Elrond if I ever saw him. Like,
yeah. Sure.
So I would have loved to see David Bowie as Elrond. I think that would be great. I think Hugo Weaving and David Bowie are quite similar. Maybe there needs to be one of those like Bob Dylan style movies, which is called
I'm Not There.
I never know if it's I'm Not There, I'm Still Here or whatever, because all those movie titles sound the same.
Yeah.
Where like Hugo Weaving, Tilda Swinton, a lot of people just like play these versions of David Bowie. Like if we're going to do musical biopics, let's do that.
Yeah.
Who else?
I can't move past Tilda Swinton. I feel Tilda
Swinton.
They're
the same person.
They're literally some made from the same mold.
I know. I always kind of see them from the same planet at least.
Yeah,
like
exactly,
whatever planet
that
is. I don't know who else we'd cast in that. Let us know if you're listening. Who else would you put in the weird vignette-y David Bowie biopic?
Maybe then just to end. So like, obviously it's quite clear that David Bowie enjoys performing. But why do you think he did these kinds of roles or what? And also was so drawn to cinema? Because it seems like he had a lot of fun with doing some very weird, strange things.
What I mentioned in the intro as well, I think his objective was never to become a big movie star. I think he saw creators like a David Lynch, like a Jim Henson, like some of the other directors we've talked about, and thought could be a cool like side quest. It was more I think, about the art for him than it was about like trying to break into becoming a movie star.
Yeah. I mean, we've discussed the good ones now. There are a lot of stinkers in there. Absolutely. As well. He made a film called Everybody Loves Sunshine with Goldie, like the drum and bass artist. Yeah. Really? Yeah. It's a crime film where he plays a, yeah. Oh, please go watch a look at that trailer. It's amazing. Well, the movie is not, but the trailer is amazing. You're like, what the fuck is David Bowie doing in here in this film? And it's Goldie, like with his gold teeth being it's uh-huh. like sort of the Goldie's acting career from Lockstock on, like moving into different gears, but the gear, there's, well, no car, whatever, whatever. But he financed part of that film, so, and he made a track with Goldie. So I think it was just also him, like, meeting people. Some people asked him, like, hey, I have the idea for a movie about a snowman, it's drawn, can you be the voice of the snowman? It's like, yeah, sure, you know.
Whatever. Yeah, he also narrated Peter and the Wolf.
Exactly,
like,
yeah.
I think he's just the king of side quests.
Yeah.
He loves a side quest.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
There's he has one of the best cameos in any film ever in Zoolander, where it's Hansel and Derek Zoolander needing to do a walk-off, I think they call
it.
It's
a walk-off. Yeah.
If only we had somebody to judge this, and then David Bowie comes in.
All right, who's going to call this sucker?
If nobody has any objections, I believe I might be of service.
So
it's fantastic.
I also briefly, this is not cinema, but I do want to mention his episode of Extras.
Yes.
Which is
I just wanted to say this.
Yeah.
Funny little fat man.
I think I've sold out, to be honest, but yeah, it's difficult, isn't it, when to keep your integrity when you're going for that first
little fat man who sold his soul.
The little
fat man who sold his dream.
It's really funny.
And the story that Ricky Gervais tells about this, that he met Bowie, and Bowie said, like, yeah, you can call me up. Let's see if I can be on an episode. Gervais thought, like, that's bullshit. That's never, never going to happen. He called him up, and Bowie said, like, yeah. And he said, do you also want me to write the song, like the little song that you want me to perform about you? And he wrote Funny Little Fat Man. And
king.
It's him just singing that to Ricky Gervais as this, well, everybody who's seen Extras, he's a jerk, as Ricky Gervais usually is in
real life.
In real life.
One final thing I want to shout out for people to look up is David Bowie did an appearance on a Christmas show with Bing Crosby back in the early 70s, I'm assuming, where they sing Little Drummer Boy. That in itself is hilarious. However, Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly did a bar for bar, verbatim, exactly the same camera angles, the same clothes, recreation of this David Bowie and Bing Crosby video with no jokes added in. It's just, the joke is that it's exactly the same. And it's the funniest thing you'll ever see in your life. Please
look
it up. Little Drummer Boy, Bing Crosby, David Bowie. It's very funny. You can get your tickets now for our David Bowie program at Lab 111. You can find the tickets for that at lab111.nl or through the link in the show notes.
Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab 111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. Do you love what we do? Support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts.
This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, and co-produced by myself, Laura Romans. Music comes from Hugo Emmertzell, and the artwork is by Studio FFF.